You're listening to Architecture Masters.
I think it was John Mernier was our sort of year supervisor, and he sort of made this great speech that if you want to read architecture, you have to eat, sleep, drink, live, believe architecture every minute of your day. And I thought to myself, bollocks. I've come to this wonderful place and I'm going to have some fun.
You're listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. I'm Owen Wainhouse.
Okay, I'm Michael Squire. I'm the senior partner at Squire & Partners for an architectural practice, and we're having our conversation in our new offices here in Brixton.
I'm joined this week by Michael Squire. In 1976, Michael founded his eponymous practice from a basement studio in Pimlico. Over the intervening 41 years, the practice has grown at a prodigious rate and is currently ranked as the ninth largest architecture firm in the UK, according to the AJ 100 rankings. The firm which Michael leads now employs more than 250 staff. Over the years, they've either outgrown or been outpriced from various offices, which has seen the practice move first to South Kensington and then to King's Cross, but most recently to their stunning newly restored building, the department store, in Brixton. In this week's episode, we ask what it means to create polite architecture. We talk about designing a villa for the Bin Ladens and getting paid in traveller's cheques. We talk about succession planning and why you really can do without an HR department, but really shouldn't go without buying your own building. And finally, we find out why it's so important to feel the fear. After a brief tour of his new offices, I sat down with Michael, where we started discussing those early days in practice.
You started Squire & Partners 1976, so just over 40 years from a one-man band, is that right, when you first started out? What was the...
Yes, I was, but only for a very short time.
Right.
Was I absolutely on my own. Then I was joined almost immediately by someone whose name is John Graves, and he and I worked in a basement in Ebury Street, which actually we were there because I'd previously been in practice with two friends of mine from Cambridge, Edward Hill and Charles Dorrin, and we were called Hill Squire Dorrin. And for the first, I don't know, 3-4 years of our existence, we were in what was known as the barber boom in those days, when there was a sort of flurry of activity, and we thought life was very easy. The phone kept ringing and we did very well. And we got up to about, I don't know, 8 or even 10 of us. And then we were hit with the 3-day week, change of government, the stock market collapse, everything, absolutely, all at the same time. And we had that wonderful moment when there were three partners sat around a table discussing what we were going to do, and we had one job, which was a kitchen and bathroom extension in Norfolk, thatched roof, and it didn't come off. And at that moment, we had to recognise that we weren't actually an architectural practice anymore. And my two partners went off to work in other practices at that time. I stayed in the basement, basically because we had bought a lease on this building, let most of it, but I felt it'd be quite a good idea to keep sort of in touch with it until we'd sorted it out, and that was really the reason for the commencement of the practice. And John Graves used to work for Hill Squire Dorrin. He joined me. the two of us became three after about another 9 months. Our very first work, other than kitchen and bathroom extensions and Laura Ashley wallpaper and private houses, which basically are... it starts, your first job is marriage guidance. That's the first thing you've got to do. Then you have to sort of be accountant and try and decide how much anyone can afford. And very much third and last, your architect or designer. But we became quite good at them. But then one day this Lebanese architect, and the Lebanon was being bombed to bits at the time, it was in the middle of a big civil war, came and knocked on my door, and he said he'd met somebody on an aeroplane when he was flying over to London, and he'd said, I've got all this work in Saudi Arabia and my office has been bombed and I'm going to London to find an architect to do the working drawings for me. And this person happened to be someone who I knew from Cambridge. And he said, I've got these three villas, vast villas to build. Number one of which was Villa Bin Laden, which has always sort of slightly stuck in my head in more recent times, that it was Villa Bin Laden, but of course they're a very big family in Saudi Arabia. Yeah. And would I do the working drawings for him? And I said, well, you know, you've just walked off the street, and to be honest, I don't really know. I could do all the drawings and I might never see you again. And I haven't got lots of money that I can afford to sort of burn on people to do your work if I'm not going to be paid. He said, OK, well, I'll pay you some money in advance. He said, well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I've got these traveller's checks, and they were £100 each or something, and I'm going to start signing them, and we'll build a little pile up here. And he said... when you think the pile is high enough for you to be happy to get on with my work, please tell me to stop and we'll agree at that price. But if I feel that you've gone too far, I'm going to take the pile away and see whether I can find someone else to do it. So this was quite a sort of little...
negotiating
quite a good game of poker. And anyway, in the end, we agreed, and up front pavement, we had a terrific relationship with this architect. We did... three or four of his sort of working drawing packages, which just gave us some security in what was a really dark recession. Yeah. And then other little things happened, and so we developed.
And here you are now, new offices in Brixton, AJ number 9 in the AJ 100, so that's the 100 biggest practices.
Yes, I hate that particular sort of scoring system, because it's as if size is any measure of sort of quality. But there you are, number 9 it may be.
In terms of business
yes, we do and, do yeah, some
it's a
business.
Big, yes. Yeah, big, yes. Big firm, yeah, yes. Big office. And building a huge amount in London. I mean, that's often quite, you're not building the Shard or the Gherkin, things that are... talked about in that kind of brand way. Do you think relatively you're not building blingy, would you say it goes unnoticed sometimes?
I think probably we have never been particularly heavily PR minded, so we have not sought out massive coverage. And we have carried out quite a number of projects that are polite, and they're intended to be polite because they're in locations where we think that is what is appropriate. But there are a number of projects we've carried out. I mean, Reese with its acrylic facade, One Hanover Street, which is rather an interesting little pencil, a little house covered in leaves in Mayfair, which is a little strange and unusual. And the tallest residential building, I think it will be, in on the Isle of Dogs.
That's the landmark?
What's well, the landmark were the first two. You know, this one is called City Pride, right. Which I think it's got another rather pretentious name now, but I can't remember it. But City Pride is what it's known of in this firm. And Le Montcalm Hotel is quite unusual. And we think that all our buildings are about where they are. There is not a sort of formula. Our buildings will not be the same in Hong Kong, Singapore, New York, London, which for some people, I think they would like to think they were because they're making a product. It's more like a sort of motor car. It's a very beautiful thing, but it's not necessarily to do with exactly where it is. For us, it's the reverse. Where it is what matters.
I mean, I was going to ask about the... the landmark and the buildings in Canary Wharf are kind of glass buildings, quite Mesian, maybe simple kind of. I was going to ask about that contrast, that they're very different to a lot of the brick buildings or the kind of Portland stone that you've been using. And that's because they're of Canary Wharf.
They're in Canary Wharf. And those particular buildings are designed to be very clear, simple, repetitive to build, clean line and design, but they're not trying to be a strawberry. They're trying to be something very simple and clean and clear to build. Actually, it's quite funny because they adjoin one of our first ever residential buildings, which is I think now called the Anchorage. Again, we used to call it Sufferance Wharf. I always think the first name is always better than the second, but it's now called the Anchorage, which is a building, personally, I'm still very proud of. One of our teams went and did a trip down the river the other day and sent us back photographs of it, and it still looks really calm and sort of quite sophisticated for the Isle of Dogs. But it is, for me, all about where they are and what they are, and not a sort of one design fits all.
Okay. The practice then has grown from one, two persons. You were talking about kind of size as not perhaps being the kind of measure of success, but of it's a very. I mean, the kind of change you've seen in one firm over the. I mean, you're talking about doing some of the working drawings, presumably. In the late 70s, all hand drawn, the kind of the way architecture has changed. Yeah, the practice has changed, but the way the business has changed. Yeah, in terms of techniques and things, and just interested really in how you've overseen that evolution. I mean, it's almost a different profession. Do you think? I mean, in terms of what staff are doing now, what your team are doing compared to what you were doing.
Yes, it is. I think it is a process of evolution rather than revolution, as you've said. I think we have taken on new technology as it applied. The building I was referring to, the Anchorage, was built with a set of drawings produced with a pencil and a pen, and we could make amendments 7 times because that was the number of times you could scratch a line out on a paper, after which you'd gone too through thin, the paper. Right. It's all over. Now, one of the disadvantages of the amazing capacity of the computer is you can change anything just like that at the sort of drop of a pen. And, of course, everybody does all the time. I don't think that's the most positive side of it, but it is a wonderful tool, nevertheless. And there has been an infinite increase in complexity, whether actually of building or of process, I'm not sure. Somebody asked me the other day who was the planning consultant we used for a building called Brook House, which is on Park Lane, serious new building in Westminster in 1997 or something like that. And I said, well, I can't quite remember. I'll have a look on the file. And I had a look on the file, and it transpired we didn't have a planning consultant. And not that, actually, I wouldn't move anywhere without a planning consultant today, but we probably submitted that planning application with a set of nice, clear drawings, filled in the form, passed it across perhaps a structural engineer and an M&E consultant, and that was our planning application. Now you would need a forklift truck to deliver it, you know, and the number of consultants and the complexity of the process. Does it make for better buildings? I'm sure it makes for more resolved buildings. Part of the problem for many clients is at the planning application stage, they're really testing the water rather than deciding what they want to build. So this massive investment is difficult for them. But so it's changed in that way. It's changed in the responsibility we're prepared to take. We used to, you know, obviously project manage our buildings, carry out all the site inspection and administration and certify the payments and all of these things. Very few projects are done like that by architects today. We increasingly get, you know, simply passed on to the contractor who then takes all responsibility for anything we do or draw. And that's the developer trying to pass that risk away. Again, I think we have let ourselves down as a profession by too readily accepting that we're not very good at management, we're not very good at administration, we're not very... So we'll let someone else do it. But in that way, we've had our control of projects eroded, and there it is. But on the other hand, none of them can really do anything until you've drawn the lines. Yeah. So there's still a little power held in the right place.
And you talk about drawing the right lines. Is that how you, I mean, how involved in individual projects you are now? Is that how you first come up with concepts? With, you know,
absolutely. I think, I mean, obviously I probably would say, because it's the way I do it, but I notice even amongst those of my partners, directors, associates who involve themselves a lot in the creative process, most of them start with a pen or a pencil. It's quite difficult to sort of be creative in some ways on a computer at that stage. Later you can make a magic image from it, but you need to be freer than that. The trouble with the computer is it asks you, you know, 0.1111 centimetres, you know, whereas the thickness of the line of the pen is much more where you are at that stage. And the answer to your other question is I still draw all the time. I'm only happy when I'm drawing. Unfortunately, I have to say, particularly with this move, perhaps in the last 3 or 4, 5 months, my concentration on the building in Brixton, and particularly, you know, we've got a restaurant at the top, an event space at the bottom, 3 or 4 tenants along the ground floor. It's required a lot of administrative time, which I do not enjoy. It's not what I want to do. But even in the last week, I have done the initial drawings for 3 schemes, partly because my partners are away and it's August, but I thoroughly enjoy it.
That's,
and it's what I would always want to do.
Wait until they're on holiday.
Exactly.
Great. You talked a little bit then about change in the kind of in the practice of architecture. You've talked in kind of other places about change, I guess, in the city, you know, starting from South Kensington, mm-hmm. to Pimlico, mm-hmm. to King's Cross, down to Brixton. I mean, the...
pretty weird selection of locations, well, you will probably say, but...
All along the Victoria line, really. I mean...
yes.
London's, as a city, has changed. Mm. I mean, it's almost unrecognisable, is it, from when you started?
Yes, I think that is true. One forgets, because change happens so slowly in many ways that you only suddenly realize, my God, this is completely different to what it was. But I do remember in the early days of working in London in the late 70s, early 80s, there were very few new buildings built in London. Yeah. You didn't see any tower cranes. We did refurbishments and additions and alterations. Mm-hmm. We didn't, not only we didn't, I think architects, I mean, yes, office buildings in the city probably did exist. They did. Shopping centres were being built in sort of Croydon and places like that. But residential development in London, other than obviously local authority residential, but that had slightly ground to a halt, there was just very little new building in London, particularly probably in the West End. And that has completely sort of reversed and turned itself upside down. But fortunately, and I have great respect for the Westminster planners who I cross swords with on many occasions in my life, but they, after having done Centrepoint and the Hilton and a few others, suddenly decided, Rosemary McQueen in particular, decided that Westminster would maintain its heritage and its parapet line and its scale. It's very dense because all the buildings are very close together, but it would try to cherish its heritage. I find it quite entertaining that the city, on the other hand, partly because probably of the rivalry from Docklands and things of that kind, decided they would keep all their precious heritage, but wherever there was a gap, they would allow whatever wildness to happen, and I quite enjoy that. I think the juxtaposition of those sort of buildings can be fascinating. And then, again, you have Canary Wharf, which is just what it is. Clear, clean expanse of new building. But I think that the fascination of London is just so much variety. I mean, even I've lived in London all my life, and I can still be dropped down somewhere where my daughter suddenly decided to buy a flat and say, I've never seen this before. It's absolutely amazing, isn't it? You know, there's still such variety, and it's an amazing city.
And a huge amount of your work is still in London as a practice. Is that by design? There's kind of a smattering of international work, but still the bulk in London?
An awful lot of things have gone quite well for me during my life, but I would never have the conceit that I had planned them all. circumstances draw you in so many different directions. I never wanted to be 250 people, I can assure you that. Constantly I would have said throughout the early part of my life, I never want to be a big practice. But it's incredibly difficult to manage an architectural practice because having been through a number of catastrophic collapses in the market, I never have certainty. If you decide to turn a job down, what actually happens is you get about 8 inquiries, roughly, for one real new project. Probably, that's something like that. Now, if you want to now manage your projects, which of the 8, you might always turn down the one that was going to come off and you'll end up with no projects at all. You, it's impossible to really... If you knew anybody who comes in the door, that's a new project, I'll take 5 of those this year, thank you, I've got what I want, finish. Yeah. But it isn't like that.
They don't all come in with their traveller's checks and pile on them.
Quite. Yeah, well, that's a nice one. A lot of our work was Central London. And what happens to you... In my experience, is when we started, we did people's private houses in Fulham and extensions to them and those things, and everybody said, that's what you do, you're really good at that. Yeah. And they gave us a lot of those. They never dreamt of asking us to do an office building. Then you do an office building, and our first was 150 Brompton Road, which we got by coincidences and strange events. And then suddenly, oh, you do West End office buildings, but we wouldn't get you to do any residential because you wouldn't know what you were doing. And then more recently, we've done quite a lot of this very high value private residential. Yeah. Oh, yes, but you don't do residential in sort of, you know, the East End or whatever. Well, actually, we do. But, but you know, so, but because we did quite a lot quite early, because as I say, it didn't start until a third of the way through my career, quite a lot quite early in Westminster and central London. A lot of people decided we were the right people to do that, not to do buildings in the city. We've hardly done any buildings in the city.
That's interesting.
Not because we wouldn't be very good at it, yeah. but because that wasn't...
That
exactly, we weren't okay. along that road. And we did quite a lot, as it happens, on the Isle of Dogs, and so we've done quite a lot in East London. But the only time I really, actually, took a really positive decision to sort of try and compete with that was about a week after the decision to leave Europe, which I thought was a disastrous decision, but that's a matter of opinion. But I did quite specifically then get on an aeroplane and look for work abroad, and we have actually now got projects in Cairo, quite close with one in Amman, Dubai, the Vida Hotel, Kuwait, Abu Dhabi, Maker's District, and even one in Karachi, which is quite strange. And previously we had one in St. Petersburg and one in Moscow. So we are doing more abroad, but it was never something that I said, I must do this. My father, his practice was almost exclusively abroad. He did Hilton Hotels. They were done with a construction company called Cementation, and they were financed through a thing called ECGD, Economic Development Grants or something. And they gave, the government gave grants to developers building Hilton Hotels all around the world, providing they used British goods and British expertise. And so he worked a lot abroad, and I saw the toll it took upon him. And I also noticed, because I worked in his office for a while, that therefore if you worked in that office, you never really got to see the building, because we didn't all fly abroad to see them all the time. And that he never got paid his last installment. And I thought... And he basically probably didn't work in London because there wasn't any work in London. But I did slightly say to myself, I'm going to try not. For other people, it's a great romance to work abroad. Not so much for me, but now we are by default working abroad.
By protection, by necessity. Really,
protection, by necessity. Protection, very good word, yes.
Yeah. And do you feel, I mean, that's, you know, say, 250 staff, you know, that's, I mean, the AJ we're talking, you know, in there, AJ 100, 24 million a year in income. I mean, you'd be bringing in huge numbers of clients in order to feed 250, I mean, literally feed with a restaurant on the top, but feed those mouths. Do you feel that as a...
Well, I share the burden, but it is, you know, a big... burden that you carry on your shoulders when you employ 250 people. If you didn't care about asking 100 of them to leave next month, it wouldn't be a problem. But that doesn't sit very well with any of us. We're very, very close to our staff. I remember somebody saying to me quite a long time ago, early 90s, or maybe a bit later than that, the way you run your business and your relationship with your staff and your kind of closeness and your family atmosphere is going to be a real problem for you, because as you get bigger, you're not going to be able to do that. And you get too close to people, and then next week you've got to ask them to leave. But I fundamentally don't agree with that. Most people kind of know when those terrible things have to happen, and they certainly have at least twice, maybe three times in my life, but they're awful because you're normally asking people to leave in a period where you know perfectly well there are no easy jobs for them outside, and they are people you have become very close to. But if you've always been genuine, and I mean, I refuse to have an HR department. I regard that as the moment when you've tried to pass all your...
The response to someone else. Yeah.
And then everybody goes to their lawyers and it all becomes... Yeah. Whereas if you deal, which we do as far as we can, and now obviously there are other partners and directors involved in the process, but do try to deal really personally and directly with people, I think it's the way to make it work. But it does...
Take a burden.
Yeah, it means you don't always sleep that easy at night. And right now, I'm just constantly thinking about where is the next job that will replace that job, and you know that's the price you pay.
Yeah. And that, in terms of picking up new work, we don't. I mean, MIPIN is one place. A lot of the bigger practices are around, and. Perhaps some of the more kind of showy architects are there talking about themselves and making a kind of a song and dance. That, one suspects, is not your style, but you're obviously successful in picking up clients and presumably repeat clients, you know, in Canary Wharf and in London, you know, people just wondering what
Sadly, nothing like the number of repeat clients I would like. I think if you're an accountant... and you do a good job of someone's accounts, you will do his accounts next year and maybe for the rest of his life. Yeah. In architecture, it isn't. We've done fantastic jobs for a client such as Unison, who we did a wonderful building for, who love it. But they're not going to build another building.
They only need one headquarters.
They only need one. And even developers... really liked, we'd like to try someone new, you know, we'd like to do something different. It's repeat work we do have, but not as much as I would like to think we could. As to the business of, I don't think I'm not a natural sort of showboater, so that's probably what you're referring to. But actually I love... engaging with a new client, and then I love to sell what we do, but probably not quite so sort of overtly publicly as other people might. I don't know.
Obviously, when you're out there winning work, there's competition around. You know, that clients will be talking to other other practices, or how much that kind of competition comes in. I mean, how close are you with the other kind of big name architects in the profession? Is there a club? How much do you? I mean,
there is a thing called the Architecture Club, funnily enough, which I sit on the committee of.
But right.
I don't. I think actually architects are very bad at really kind of embracing each other, partly because we are always in competition. I think if you're, say, an estate agent, you've got to get mates with all the other estate agents because you're passing business around. We're not passing business around. We're trying to get some to keep it for ourselves. But certainly, more recently, I put a lot of value on having relationships with other architects who are doing, you know, similar things, and talking with them about the ups and downs of the whole painful process. And I certainly don't shun them at all. I mean, we're doing our launch here in the middle of September, and I think, I don't know, 10 or 12 architects we know quite well we've invited. Whether they'll come, that's up to them. But, you know, it's not... We're not too sort of standoffish about architects. Okay. I like architects.
Maybe then, I mean, I was interested in, you talking a little bit about Brexit and the impact that is and will have on the on the firm. Politics obviously has a huge effect. You talked a little bit about some of the planners and things on the effect of London. But you've never, with the mayor's office, you've never, I mean, maybe it's done behind closed doors. I mean, how much do you engage with governmental figures or with...
I don't think I do enormously engage in that sort of way. I mean, I've always had good relationships with people at Westminster, particularly, and indeed in the mayor's office over a long time, as much with the officers as with the politicians. I'm not a great one. I mean, I sit on the Kensington Chelsea Design Review body, you know, and that's an interesting process. I'm not sure whether 10 architects necessarily make the original scheme any better, but they give their views. But I don't think, I'm not very clubby. Right. I'm not, I don't know, I'm interested in politics, but I've always sort of thought my dream politician would stand up and say, here's my kind of, you know, portfolio, or this is what I'm going to do, and there's nothing on the piece of paper. And he gives you 5 years of total peace and quiet to get on with what you want to do. And I think probably I'm more interested in doing it, in actually building. I can remember somebody coming to an interview with us many years ago, and he said, yeah, yes, I know your practice very well. You never talk about it. You just build it, don't you? And maybe that is who we are. It hasn't been a great sort of policy or anything. People are who they are, and I'm more interested in doing it.
In doing, yeah. I thought I might just jump back. Right, so you did your MA in Cambridge. Was there an undergraduate degree before then? Was that, where did you?
Well, the that BA was, becomes an MA.
Right, okay.
It wasn't, I did my
undergraduate.
Yeah. I think you pay another 60 quid at Cambridge.
Right. And it becomes
something
an
like
MA.
That, yeah. Okay. I mean, a year later. No, I did, I did my degree at Cambridge, then did a year out, and then went back and did 2 more years at Cambridge, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I have to say, I was not an obsessive student. I can remember being told when we first arrived, I think it was John Mernier was our sort of year supervisor, and he sort of made this great speech that if you want to read architecture, you have to eat, sleep, drink, live, believe architecture every minute of your day. Yeah. And I thought to myself, bollocks. I've come to this wonderful place and I'm going to have some fun.
Yeah.
And but nevertheless, I thoroughly enjoyed being at Cambridge, and therefore went back. I kind of flirted with going to the AA for my diploma, but in the end went back to Cambridge and enjoyed it.
And it was always, you say your father was an architect. It was predestined, was it? Was that always, I mean, what before university, what did you study?
I did art for A levels. I did art, English. I loved English. And history, which I wasn't particularly brilliant at. But I always did. I mean, my family talked architecture all the time. We drove around and, you know, he'd be saying, I mean, my brother didn't become an architect. He became a property developer. But certainly it was in my, the pencil was in my hand very, very early.
Right.
And I love drawing, you know, so it came to me very naturally. And I still absolutely adore drawing. Okay. If I, you know, talk to a client, I want the, you know, site layout as early as possible, and then I just want to get and start to get out the pencil.
And that must be infectious. Your son now is an architect in, yeah, partner indeed, in
yes,
and partners.
Yes, yes. My son is... He's a very perceptive eye for what's right and what's wrong. He's not probably quite so obsessed with drawing as I am, but he does draw very nicely. But he's also a brilliant communicator and leader of people. I mean, in this firm, the strength of this firm is really the fact that there is an almost indestructible second generation. There is an obvious
succession.
Yes, it doesn't all have to be cobbled up and contrived, because I think all, and there are so many, I mean, 80% of this firm are probably under 40, 35 maybe. And they all look up to Henry, and he's got a great way with them. I mean, not that the other partners are not as well, but he is particularly good at communicating and talking to people and making them feel they've got a place, and it's a great strength.
And that, I mean, the building obviously directs how the practice feels to a large extent. You know, you're over three floors, four floors. Certainly some of the people we've spoken to for the podcast before, running much smaller practices, 20 people, 15 people, where you've got an idea about what everyone is working on and what they're doing. Once you get bigger, how do you pick what you get involved with, and how you, I mean, are you literally walking the corridors? Are you, you know, interrogating people in crits? In, you know, how does the office kind of?
Yeah, we've made a rather good rule that you're not allowed to use the lift, and so everybody kind of meets on the staircase. And I had to have a replacement knee, and they said to me, the most important thing is that you kind of exercise this knee all the time. And so this is my gymnasium. Right. I am up and down those stairs all the time. But formally, we do design review 8:30 Friday morning every week. It's probably 2 hours, probably two projects, but every project at intervals during its process comes to design review, and that's all the partners together. They're not all always there, but that's the object of the exercise. And we debate and discuss our work, and it is incredibly important to all of us that although, as I say, the individual projects may appear quite disparate in some ways, they have a process of being realized and a story that explains how they occurred that has to be shared and respected and understood. And we do that basically by design review. I also love just walking around the building, and particularly we have a department that does the CGIs. We do all our presentation in-house. Right. So that's model shop, CGI, I mean, and illustration.
The model shop downstairs that would make some universities jealous, I think.
It's a wonderful model shop. Yeah. It's intended to make everybody jealous. That they made this when we were moving in here. We had this thing where everybody could put up on the wall their little dream of their space and what it might be like. A model shop made a model, needless to say, which just sort of said model shop on it. And they had a long sort of spike and a big gold sort of balloon on the end of it. And they just said, because they used to work in the basement, we'd like to see a bit of that, if you wouldn't mind. And they do now, because they're our shop window. But I find that the most productive thing, if you want to just keep an eye on exactly what's happening in your office, is to walk round model shop, CGI, and illustration, because all the projects are...
You can see what's...
That's what's popping up. Yeah. But we also, Monday morning, so I've given you Friday morning, Monday morning, and there was a brand new project I hadn't seen was presented this morning. And Monday morning is down in the event space. Did you see that in the basement? Yeah. And so each Monday morning, either one, maybe two people speak up and talk about a project they're doing. It may be at any stage, it may be, you know, nearing completion or right at its inception. And they try and reveal things that work, things that didn't work, you know, successes and failures, and communicate to people what's going on in the office. Because that cross-fertilization, I think, is crucial. And the bigger you get, the harder it is. Like, you very easily get into cells, but we try very hard not to be cells.
And how, I mean, yeah, absolutely no idea. How many projects would a firm of this size be working on at the same time? What kind of projects of scale, yeah, that were kind of...
Well, it's terribly hard to get your head around that.
There are probably
I should think there must be 60 or 70 live projects.
At one stage or another, yeah.
There would then be another 30 or 40 that are dormant but not dead.
Yeah.
But of your 60, probably only 20 are actually going to be built, you know, are in the stage of being built, let's put it that way. And that's a guess, but it's something like that. I mean, on our three floors, we actually have work going on. I'm sure there are 5 or 6 real live, quite significant construction projects being built. Mm. So that's 18, 20. But then there will be another 40 that are in some sort of stage. Nowadays, now that we have uncertainty of a quite severe level, the property developer doesn't want to press the button and say go, because that's a hell of a commitment in an uncertain time. Equally, the people who work for him want to show that they're doing very useful things. Yeah. So we are doing lots of feasibility studies. Let's look at this project again and see whether we can, you know, evolve it and make it more successful. So that means you're working on an awful lot of things at the same time.
I mean, in terms of the kind of, you say you moved to King's Cross, you've been quoted in, it's an old Evening Standard article talking about how rough King's Cross was when you moved in and the kind of the change there. This is obviously, this new building is a huge investment. You bought the building and now, so you've got some certainty about being here and presumably space to expand. You know, there's flexibility in the building anyway. It feels a real showcase for your work in terms of, you know, feels luxurious and feels solid and feels very warm as a building.
No, well, that's nice, and I think that is a very fair description. I mean, it's interesting because we were originally in Ebury Street, as I say, and then we moved to Cromwell Place, which was South Ken. Then we moved across the street to another building in South Ken. But one thing I concluded very early, I concluded it in about, actually, 1989, when we had the biggest crisis of my life. We went from 60 people to 10 in the space of a weekend. We just had to just empty our building of our friends, and that was not a nice experience. But I observed what was happening to other quite substantial practices, who shall be nameless. They could lay off their staff, but they had taken expensive West End property, and they were done for a rent review a year or two before at the top rent. And landlords are merciless people. Yeah. They were not going to say, you can go back to half the rent. No. And I thought to myself then, I'm not going to be done by the landlord. Right. I would rather borrow the money and pay the interest. Yeah. And that has served me very well. I still own my building in Cromwell Place. Right. We still own our building in Wicklow Street, which we've let. When we went from Cromwell Place to Wicklow Street, we were slightly trying to say, because in Cromwell Place we were a little studio and we'd picked up some quite significant projects, and the bank surveyor would come round and say, well, I don't know whether this people are really kind of big enough to handle this job. So when we landed in Wicklow Street, we did make it quite sort of corporate in its way, very clean, white. I don't know whether you went there. Have you been there?
No.
well, they were beautiful offices, but very architectural and, you know, lines of desks and sort of nice stairs and spaces and volumes. And then they came up there and they said, oh, well, of course they could handle this work. We were the same people, you know, but it just looked like you could. But we slightly, I think, when we were contemplating coming here and looking at this building, didn't feel we needed to prove that anymore. No. So it could be a more personal building again, a more sort of about who we are and what we are. And we loved the building. And as we slowly unveiled it, it sort of never let us down. It just kept producing more and more delight. And we made our volumes, which weren't that clever as far as the valuer was concerned. But I said, don't you worry, we could always floor them in if all goes wrong. But I see it, I really personally don't want to expand anymore at all. But we do under-occupy here. We've got nearly double the space. Well, we'd taken some outbuildings up at King's Cross, but than our core building, we've got nearly double the space, which means you'll probably notice we occupy it in quite a relaxed way. But we've got virtually the same outgoings, and the truth of the matter is, you know, you can all say how clever you were to go to King's Cross, but I only went to King's Cross because it was cheap. And I've only left King's Cross because it's expensive. And I've only come here because it's cheap. But actually, I would say Brixton has so much more of a sort of community spirit. Yeah. It's a real place. Yeah. King's Cross is a railway station, and however many Googles go in there, it's not going to be a community. It's an itinerant population. Down here, there's some real people, and they've, you know, there's always that little thing, are you gentrifying us and all of that? But equally, we've had a lot of people really welcoming us with open arms, and we're doing quite a lot with the, you know, Brixton Design Trail and that kind of thing. And we're very, very pleased to have come here. And it is a good business decision, and it is the crucial thing you have mentioned, which is on the Victoria line. As far as I'm concerned, I'm so boring about the Victoria line, but it's the only line in London. It goes 1 minute, you know, 1 minute, 1 minute, and it connects to every other line you could ever want to get onto. So
and right through, you know, through the West End, where the bulk of your work.
I mean, if we used to have to travel from King's Cross to Green Park, you don't want to do it in a taxi, you know, however rich you are. It'll take you hours, you know, but it'll take you about 10 or 12 minutes. And we're about exactly the same number of stops, maybe one more, going in the other direction. And although one of my partners is quite seriously far north London. It has been quite a struggle for him, because he never really believed anything happened the other side of the blue thing that ran through the town. He's certainly reconciled himself to it, and most people, there's a big smile on the faces of most of the people going up and down the stairs. They love it here.
It's a very generous office, really. And then finally, maybe I'm just kind of interested in some of your, we talked a lot about London and the, you know, the changing nature of the city. I was interested in some of your inspiration, maybe, you know, in terms of, you talked about seeing new things in London, some of the buildings, some of the new projects in London, things that inspire you now in the capital. Is there, are there parts of London, I mean, are you generally optimistic about London's future, or about projects particularly that are taking shape that you think?
I think apart from our political chaos, I think I am very confident about London. I think it's an amazing city. We have an incredible connection to the rest of the world, probably as a result of the fact that the whole world speaks American. Or English. And I think it is a sort of slightly strange outcome of the empire, love it or hate it. It connected us to an enormous part of the world, and people love to come to London. In terms of what kind of I find fascinating about London actually is not so much its new buildings, although I think we have better and better new buildings. I do think there has been, that would be another significant change in my life. Probably early on in my career, the people who did get projects to build in London, mainly offices, were hard-nosed commercial practices, net to gross, what is it? The swing of public opinion, planning, I don't know what. It has become much more sophisticated, and clients have felt the need, whether they like it or not, to employ architects who can wave a little of a magic wand over what they're doing and that people will actually enjoy and like it. I don't think that worried the earlier developers after the war. So I think that's a very positive thing. But the things, what I love in London, and the thing that actually our current sort of planning legislation slightly militates against, is actually its density, the sort of proximity of spaces, and then you will burst out into a slightly wider space. I mean, go around the city, there's some crazy little sort of streets and connections. Now, you would spend your whole time discussing with the planner that, oh, well, we need 20 metres or there's overlooking. Yeah. Well, actually, in many of those streets, you could shake hands with your next-door neighbour, you know. And I went and stayed in New York because my daughter was working over there for one Christmas, and we stayed in a flat in Soho or somewhere, and I got to know about four different families who were around the back of me. But I could always pull the blind down if I wanted a bit of privacy. I don't get this obsession with... And what that does, and has done in London down the river, is if in a residential block, they turn it at right angles to the river so everybody gets a view. Yeah. It's about 20 metres wide. The planner tells them they can't put one any closer than another 20 metres. And so what you get is this relentless sort of 20-metre blocks boom, down onto the river. And I think that is tragic. So just trying to engage a little bit more with the sort of accidents of medieval cities and planning is something that I'm very fascinated by at the moment. And we have done it a little bit at Tower Bridge. I don't know whether you know that scheme. Yeah. You know, and you get one a little Tower narrow Bridge, street. Yeah, and people said, well, no one will ever buy a flat there. Yeah. But actually, they love those flats. And, you know, it's not all about seeing as how far away from somebody you can get.
And that, I mean, that density is an interesting, you're talking about New York, that density. London's traditionally not a hugely dense city. Do you think London needs to get, you know, is there an issue about density, do you think?
Well, we've got no choice. We've got three choices, actually. Yeah. I used to promote compulsory euthanasia at the age of 70. Unfortunately, I'm having to push the date on a little bit just now, but it would be a very good solution. And in the last 10 years, you could go completely mad and do whatever you want because you knew you were going to go. Yeah. But you either got to do that, or you've got to say, you can only, any one person can only produce one more child, or until we own up to those ghastly sort of truths, we're going to have to intensify our development. Yeah. I mean, you can go on saying you'd rather not, but we're going to have to. Yeah. But I do find it fascinating that somewhere like Mayfair, you take a sort of Google photograph of Mayfair from above, it's incredibly dense, but it doesn't rise much above five or six stories. And I think if you calculated the area per acre, it's very dense. So you can achieve, if your density is achieved by going very high, but you leave a great big gap before the next building, what is that space and is it very useful? And you aren't that much more dense than... But I don't. There's not one answer to all things. You know, it's a right solution for the right places. But I do find that subject quite fascinating and inspiring when it's sort of done well.
And lastly, then, maybe just, you know, someone in a basement flat or a basement studio in Pimlico starting their own firm today. Any, you know, hoping to to grow. Yeah, any words of advice? What would you...
Don't grow.
Don't grow.
You can help it. Stop at 60.
Stop.
No, I don't know. I think you just have to be completely honest to yourself. You have to work like a dog. There's no question about that. You have to want to do it. You have to have a little bit of fear, I think. I notice in my son, because he's been brought up in a quite successful firm, actually he gets it a little bit. But quite a lot of the people at a senior level in my office think it'll always all be fine. You know, you have to be frightened to make sure you are just really
on it.
Watching on it. Yeah. It's that great, the business rule that I always quote is, I think it's Mr. Micawber, it's one of those Dickens books, and he says, 19 shillings and sixpence income and 20 shillings outgoing, bad businesses. 19 and 6 outgoings and 20 shillings income, good business. And if you can just project as far as you can, look at what you're spending and what you're earning, and grow and enjoy and love every minute of it, because it is a terrific profession. You know, I see so many of my friends are all retiring and they're sick to death of it, and they've been lawyers or accountants or in the city, and they don't really love what they do. And I can't retire, much to the regret of my younger partners, who I'm sure are dying for me to go. But I love it. And particularly, I think actually we have a quite magic formula with three pretty driven sort of 40-year-olds and one old boy who they wheel in when called for.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Fuel. That's a real
pleasure.
A real inspiration.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. My guest this week has been Michael Squire. You can find out more about Michael and his work at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. You can also follow us on Twitter. If you've enjoyed the podcast, why not leave a review on iTunes or via your podcast provider, as this helps others to discover the programme. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.